Hi, I'm Molly Wood, and welcome to a little something we are calling the Source Code. Basically, every interview that I do for Marketplace Tech goes way longer than the 2.5 minutes you hear on the broadcast because I am undisciplined. We give you a little more in the podcast, but some people or topics are so interesting that I know people are going to want to geek out completely and skip all the editing and the music and the graphical user interface of radio and go straight to, see what I'm getting at here? The Source Code. That's what this is. It's the virtually untouched version of my conversation with sci-fi author William Gibson. He is, you may know, the author of Neuromancer, among many other books. He invented the word cyberspace, and his books seem to have this uncanny knack for predicting parts of the future, even though, as you're going to hear, he doesn't like to admit it. Now, one thing to know before we dive in is that Mr. Gibson and I spent a lot of time talking about a book called The Peripheral. It came out in 2014. It is a novel about a world in which multiple futures are happening simultaneously, and people from one future are able to manipulate the events in another one. The future that's being manipulated is called a stub. You're going to hear him say that word a bunch. Also, in the future doing the manipulating, most of humanity has died in a combination of catastrophe and plague and war. They call that series of events the jackpot, but the technology in that future is ultra advanced. It's a potential future that is kind of bugging William Gibson, as I think you'll hear. And if you haven't read the book yet, I'm pretty sure you're going to want to after you hear this. So without further ado, here is William Gibson, The Source Code. So this phrase, the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed yet, is yes. A theme that's present in a lot of your writing. It is attributed to you. Did you actually say it?
I'm sure I did. And probably many times before it was remarked on, but it was something in conversation, possibly in an interview. But given that I'm a sort of hoarder of my own good lines, I felt it was so apt, at least in regard to what I was doing, that I could use it over and over. But there's no precise written work of mine that anyone's ever been able to attribute it to.
Well, we'll give it to you. Do you feel like it's something that applies so broadly, not just to your writing, but also to the world around us?
Well, when I first uttered it, I'm sure that I assumed that it had always been the case. It's not something about, wow, here we are in futurity itself. It's been like that. I mean, at one time, we can imagine there was a small group of people who had discovered iconography. They could make crude images of something. And they were the first people ever to do that. If we look at the history of colonialism over the last 500 years, you see the strangers turn up and they have all this crazy tech that you can't even get your head around. That was the future. Mm. But nobody else had it.
What do you think are the consequences, even the ones you've laid out in your books, of technology not being evenly distributed?
Well, in my second novel, one of the characters thinks the very rich are no longer even remotely human. And she thinks that because the guy she's talking to, it's like 800 pounds of cancerous human cells living immortally in an Olympic swimming pool. But he's a very rich dude. So no one is so vulgar as to question the state of his existence. And so you have actual, in real life, billionaire tech entrepreneurs casually announcing that they expect to live a very long time indeed because they can buy the blood of young people and be transfused by it on a very regular basis. And they can, and they'll pay for it, and it'll be legal. But that's getting seriously, seriously weird, I think. And who's going to stop them?
Right.
And indeed, should anyone stop them? So you have one group of people with perhaps three times the expected lifespan of the rest of the planet. Where will that be after a few hundred years?
This is a theme that's present in all of your writing that I have read, but The Peripheral to me seemed like the first time that you really played this idea out to its almost inevitable conclusion, where you have a story involving multiple futures. One takes place after a series of events has essentially killed off most humans. But one thing that interested me is that you said society had been on the cusp of a series of discoveries, basically the singularity, that would have saved most people, but they came too late. How similar do you think that future is to present day?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not actually prescient. A big part
of my... You
always
say that, and yet...
I know. I always say it, but people don't... There's a kind of cultural blindness that tends to miss all the things that I don't correctly predict or that I simply failed to predict. My favorite example is that there are no cell phones in Neuromancer, and I suspect that a kid today picking up Neuromancer would get 20 pages into it and think, I got it. The whole thing is about why there's no cell phones in the future. But it isn't. I just had, I totally missed that one. And I miss lots of them. So when I posit something in a work of fiction, I'm actually doing it in hope that people will find their own questions to ask about that, rather than to do the kind of late H.G. Wells thing of saying, I have seen the future and you are doomed. That, you know, it's not, that's not my thing.
Is there then a precipitating observation? For example, in The Peripheral, only the rich survive. We're pretty stratified by class right now. In the world, we're less and less evenly distributed. Do you look around the world and say, okay, this is how I'm going to play out this scenario, or this is the germ of the idea?
That's another part of my program, such as I have one. And that's simply employing late 19th century literary naturalism to my futuristic templates. So I'm describing these possible future paths in terms of my own sense of where, not so much of where we're going, but of where we've been. You know, I'm looking at the past for my models of the future. Because if you look at history, that turns out to be, if you kind of run up and down the timeline, looking at it that way turns out to be not such a bad way to go. Like, look at what people knew in 1800 and what they knew in 1900 and what they thought about it in between, and you have a model of how the human apprehension of the future works. And you can apply it to the next century and the one after that.
So then does that just involve taking a very broad view of technology? Like you said, in the 15th century, all the great tech might have been gunpowder. By the time you get to Spook Country, maybe it's augmented reality. Does it matter what the technology itself actually is?
I don't think it generally does. There are special cases. My personal jury is still out on the evolution of informational technologies, which I would say currently runs from, the first cave wall drawing to augmented reality or whatever has probably already replaced it in some lab somewhere. The informational technologies are very mysterious in the way they change us. And consequently, I think I've always been especially fascinated by them because I sensed that early on in my looking at these things that the infotech stuff was a little different.
Yeah, it's funny. In the Big End trilogy, I often felt like you were using technology as almost a secret language, you know, that only certain people could understand or access, like a priesthood. Are you saying that information technology could be, in the long term, more, you know, profoundly world-changing than guns or fire?
I think so, but I've never come up with, you know, a slug line for it. I'm still working on that. It's something like the way in which in the Anthropology 101 concept of culture, one can never know one's own culture because one perceives everything through it, literally everything through it. And information technologies, as they become more sophisticated or maybe simpler, and maybe augmented reality is simpler than the scratching on the mammoth bone because you don't have to interpret it as much. It's simpler from the consumer's point of view in the way that in order to read a reasonably sophisticated novel or even in order to read a really crude and primitive novel, you have to be culturally trained in school for a number of years in order to look at these black marks on a white page and hallucinate. That's not a natural thing.
But you're saying with augmented reality, it could be fed to you through glasses?
Yeah, it could be fed to you, and ideally with augmented reality, you're not really making any distinction between the objects in the room and the virtual objects that are interacting with the objects in the room.
What do you mean when you say information technology? Because I hear you saying augmented reality. Do you also mean social media? Do you mean technologies we haven't brought up yet?
Literally everything from the first scratching on a bone, which would have been the beginning of an attempt to scratch on the bone in such a way that when you showed the bone to somebody, they'd say, that's a mammoth or that's your grandmother. That was an information technology. It's mm-hmm. not like we invented this stuff 100 years ago. We've been doing this since we came out of the savannas, or probably before we came out of the savannas. We've been doing it as best we could. And it seems to me that the ability to replicate images each time it's happened has been a huge breakthrough. I mean, when it took an artisan a week to make a crude likeness of the king, crude likenesses of the king were really special, and you could take them into the surrounding countryside and give them to your local village leader as a token of his power and whatnot. But as soon as you started minting them on coins, they became something else. And you had money, and everything changed. Everything changed when we learned to print books, when we learned to print relatively quickly, and we were mass producing information. Photography changed everything, but there was no one to observe that from sufficiently far away. Like, no one living in the instance of one of those changes has the distance to do that. And I was conscious of that when I started writing science fiction, and I suspected that we were in the fairly early stages of one of those events. Mm-hmm. So part of my very deliberate strategy was to learn as little as possible as I could about the actual technology, mm-hmm. which drove a lot of more traditional science fiction writers who I was meeting at the time absolutely nuts. So when Neuromancer was published, there was a chorus of outrage from those writers saying, this guy knows nothing. He knows nothing about contemporary computer technology. There can never be enough bandwidth to support any of this fantasy nonsense. And I said, yeah, but, you know, it'll happen. And the thing is, it happened in about 2 years. I mean, it didn't. We didn't have to wait very long. But I was actually able to do that because I knew nothing about what I was talking about, which is paradoxical, I know, but I think it was absolutely true. It gave me a kind of distance. And then I avoided the internet for a decade. You know, all of my science fiction writer buddies were communicating on The Well and bulletin boards and things. And I was just sitting back with my fax machine, actually savoring my ability to sociologically observe how they were being altered by their use of the internet. But I caved, you know, they would complain about me doing this. I'd say, oh, it's the learning curve is too steep. I'll do it when dogs and children can do email. And then when the World Wide Web came, dogs and children could do email. So I had no excuse. And then I was immediately sucked into it and probably lost a great deal of perspective.
Yeah, how do you get that back, do you think? I feel like everyone I know is struggling with putting the phone down, just at its most simplest.
Well, what I'm actually thinking of is a sort of innocence. So I don't think we do get that back. That's the nature of innocence. As to the unplugging thing, I don't know. I'm not very good at it.
Yeah.
I tend to be at least slightly connected at all times, and it's come to feel very helpful. I don't know. I think I now have Google serving as a huge proportion of memory for me, sort of as a prosthetic, Google is my prosthetic memory. There are all sorts of things I would have totally forgotten if I weren't able to just kind of type them in and get, oh, yes, that. Whole bodies of esoteric knowledge are out there.
Now, your stories tend to be very dark in some ways, but why do you think that technologists themselves are so much more optimistic with this idea that technology will solve everything, that the future will be great, self-driving cars will save lives and transform cities into beautiful parks? Where do you think that disconnect comes from?
I've probably expressed it best in what I think is my other most oft quoted line, and that's that the street finds its own uses for things. And historically, the developers and inventors of emergent technologies haven't imagined what people will actually do with the thing they've just developed. And in fact, it's pretty well impossible to know what that people will do with your new gizmo until enough people have it. Historically, the changes brought on by new technology have been completely unanticipated. And for me, that's sort of a key to naturalism in science fiction. If you have a future in which people are only using the powerful new technology for that purpose which its inventor invented it for, you're missing it. You're not telling a realistic story.
I feel like you're writing often the characters are people to whom the world is happening, who are just getting by in it.
Well, in naturalistic fiction, in realistic fiction, people are people to whom the world is happening. And actually, the characters who think they're in control of that, it's all happening to them too. They just don't know it yet, and it's probably going to happen a little differently. I had this kind of loose program when I started to write science fiction, and it's changed a bit over the years, but not that much. And basically, I just wanted to do the opposite of all the things that had always bored me about science fiction. And one of those was that I wouldn't unthinkingly depict imaginary futures from the point of view of people who basically had it all together for the imagined world. That I'd look for people who were socioeconomically disadvantaged or marginalized in socially in some other way and see what they felt about it. Then I could cut to people who are better off, who in my work are by no means bad guys. But that was part of my program, was do the opposite thing. I had this loose list of things in my head that had been bugging me about science fiction since my late teens, or mid-teens, really.
Do you think outside the world of your books that people who do have access to technology have some sort of responsibility to those who don't?
I think so. I believe we all have some responsibility to everyone, and particularly to those who have less. But that's a political opinion of mine, or a philosophical belief of mine. And some people would consider it, lots of people would very vocally consider it to be very wrong.
You have said before that you're not predicting the future, you're just generating scenarios. Do you have a Frankenstein in there, a scenario you have come up with that you're actually afraid will become true?
You know, I've had a couple of ideas over the years that I've put into manuscripts and then removed them because I didn't want to propagate the idea. For that reason, I won't tell you what they are.
Yeah.
But I do sometimes self-edit that way. I don't have one overriding, this is the bad thing. Although it would be, I guess it would be the scenario in the peripheral, which brings about the jackpot, minus the late flowering of a kind of second level technology that the book posits, because I don't think that's, you know, at this point I'm afraid that that's not terribly unlikely. And what people generally tend to miss about the jackpot concept in the peripheral is that it's an event that's like 5 centuries long. And we're well into it. We're really, really well into it. And we're only just now getting it.
And the jackpot we should explain is essentially, you say, a combination of historical factors, right? From climate change to disease to war that ultimately result in the death of something like, what is it, 80% of the humans on Earth.
Yeah. And I chose
and so, 80%. But minus the rebirth
minus the rebirth. I chose 80% because Dr. Lovelace in his sort of first explosive ecological book, sort of launching the idea of ecology, said that he thought this is back in the 60s, he thought we were 80% over the human population that the planet could support, like right then. And there was hardly anybody on the planet. So that percentage was a nod back that way. But that's sort of my Frankenstein. All of this stuff together is, you know, all of this stuff which is totally our fault, even though we didn't know, but it's still, you know, we're the ones who caused it, and scientifically there's like zero doubt about that. But we still have enough people who won't accept that, you know, now it's sort of like we're already doing less about it.
In a lot of ways, inventors and scientists and sometimes even policymakers can be inspired by science fiction. Do you ever hope that your writing will be prescriptive in any way?
Not so much. I mean, I suppose it's natural enough to do that. I love the idea that I might write something that would cause someone to ask a question which they might not otherwise have thought to ask, and which, indeed, I myself never thought to ask. If my ambitions were prescriptive, I'd be providing answers, but that's not my way. I want to stimulate curiosity because the answers that are going to save us are going to come from questions that we haven't even thought of asking yet, and which I'm not that likely to think of asking myself.
So you want the street to find a way to use your writing?
Yes.
Do you think that there's something out there that we are not investing enough in right now that could stop us from being the people to whom the jackpot happens, or that could be really good for humanity?
Well, again, I'm not prescriptive. And I'm also, I've just in the course of this conversation, I've permitted myself to be more Cassandra-like than I usually am in my fiction. But I'm not the writer to go to for bright, practical suggestions about different ways to do things, or where one might go. I think Cory Doctorow is an interesting place to go for that sort of thing, because he thinks very practically about where we could go to radically make things better. And I scarcely do. I just sort of dwell on things as they are. And really, in the thing I found surprising about the reader reaction to The Peripheral, not the reviews, but just people I met who'd read it, was the number of people who found it kind of optimistic. And they said, oh, and that's quite a happy ending. They're all having babies and their stub is going to be upgraded and whatnot. And I thought that the end of that book was the most heartbreaking thing I had ever written, because those people in the stub are living in a real conspiracy theory. None of their elections count for anything. The world is being run by this crazy old secret police lady in future London in a different continuum, and they're just being guided along a path that will hopefully keep them from becoming extinct. But not everyone reads it the way I read it, and it's probably a good thing.
Well, you do find a fair number of technologists obsessed with the idea that we might be living in a computer simulation. I wonder if they find it kind of comforting.
Well, I suppose so. I mean, that's always been... I've been actually really kind of surprised to see people embrace that idea in the way that some people do, and in other ways not surprised, because it gets us away from, it's kind of like, this isn't real. Don't, LOL.
Yeah.
No, don't sweat it. This is just a simulation. It's kind of like it's kind of like the old, I think the old version of that, when space travel was the technology that wasn't quite here, but that we were anticipating. It was like, don't worry about what's happening here, because it's an infinite number of planets. We'll just go to another, we'll go somewhere else. We can screw this up, but we're mankind. We can, we're a bold and spacefaring race, and that's become, less appealing, although that's still around too, actually, to some mm-hmm. extent. I think maybe this is all a computer simulation. I don't know. If this is all a computer simulation, what's the actual place like?
Yeah. Well, that's what I want to know. Maybe they think it's some of the same guys who now want to run away to space are buying the computer simulation theory. So maybe they're hoping to find out.
Yeah. I kind of wish I had anticipated that faith in my first three novels. It would have fit really well in the mm-hmm. worlds of those novels, that I would have had a sect that believed in that, I would have tried to work out the implications of the belief.
Man, well, I hope it's not too late for that to appear. Before I let you go, I want to ask you what do you take in? What do you observe, and who do you talk to, and what do you read that informs your observations?
Well, I'm kind of I've become very much a creature of Twitter, and mm-hmm. I watch what the people who I think are the smartest people I'm following. I watch what they're reading and what they're watching, and that's actually become kind of a central tool for me, because otherwise I would never meet some of these people, and so you can get what a former CIA intelligence analyst thinks is like crucial reading that week. And it's a wonderfully valuable thing. And you can also get what a crazy performance artist in Iceland is doing that week. And it's broader, it's a much broader base than my social world could ever have been.
I think many of us are going to feel reassured by that. Speaking of which, you're writing a book right now. We are taking time away from that. Do you want to tell us anything about it?
Well, I was writing a book. I was working on a book through 2016 that was set in approximately the fall of 2017 in San Francisco in the tech industry. And it was, as ever, it had a central element of artificial intelligence and a young female protagonist. And basically she was hired. She's in the industry, she's known as the app whisperer. You give her your product. You put your product on her phone, and she's a kind of superpower user. And you observe how she works with your app, and then you can really improve your app. But she, for personal reasons, she's been out of work for a while, and when she goes back, she's given a whole new phone. It can't be her own phone, that has a sort of Siri-like, what she's told is like the, you know, the alpha of this new digital assistant app. And it turns out to be this, like, terrifyingly street-smart special forces operative lady who that, like, doesn't know why she's stuck in a telephone and is extremely pissed off about it. And they bond. And so that was good, and I was going along. But then November came, and the presidential election. And when I went back to, after that, I went back to work on this manuscript that just didn't work anymore because the 2017 I'd been writing in 2016 was just like some kind of stub or something. Like, I realized that there'd been something really, there'd been a fundamental fork. And I thought, okay, I'm going to have to retrofit it. And I tried that, and it was very depressing and didn't work. But then it occurred to me that what I had in, with the material I had, was a stub in which the election, the outcome of the election had gone the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it was a stub. And so I started working with that. And because it's a stub, the history of November 2016, as we know it, it is for sure and absolutely the past of the peripheral. And
I see.
So when
you say stub, I should jump in here to define. When you say stub, you mean essentially a parallel universe that occurs in a different timeline, right?
Yeah, a fork, an artificially induced fork in the timeline. So they're in a different they're in a different continuum. And so, unfortunately, I mentioned that to, I think, one of my publisher's publicists, who then said, "Oh, he's writing a book about a happy world where President Clinton is in the White House and everything is going just fine." And boy, it's anything but the case. But, you know, beyond that, it's, you know, I shouldn't go any further because it all just becomes huge spoilers, as they say. But it's much more interesting now. It's a much more interesting story now than it was in 2016. That's for sure.
Do you have a title, or I know you always read, you always write the first line first. Any chance you want to share your first line with us?
Well, I have the title, and the title is simply Agency. There's no article. It's not the agency. It's just agency. And it's agency in the sense of the capacity, the individual's capacity to affect change.
And fascinating. Yeah, that's a word we have been talking. That word has come up a lot. It's very timely.
Well, it came up, you know, it came up for me in trying to figure out what I thought was really, really going on with the personal firearms argument in the United States. And I decided that it was about that guns are, I think, guns are really about a degree of personal agency. And the question is, what degree of personal agency does a society want to allow? What degree can a society allow? So that got me thinking about agency generally. And it's interesting. I don't know. I don't know where it's going in the book, but the characters keep talking about it. So, you know, I'm hoping to learn from them.
That is so interesting, just since so much of what we've been talking about is all of your stories in which things happen to people. The world happens to us. I can't wait to see where this goes.
Well, thank you. I hope you will soon.
Me too. William Gibson is the author of many books, including Neuromancer and most recently The Peripheral and the upcoming Agency. William, thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, thank you. It's been delightful.